对呀、
啊。
Let's call the House Committee on Health Care to order for March
6th. You bring your lunch or not, you know.
Hey, guys, take it outside. And open an informational meeting on the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act compliance. We have a couple of bills, and we have an esteemed spokesman. If you'll come up and introduce yourself. He needs no introduction to anybody who's hung around this space for a long time. And I'm going to step out in a minute to go next door to testify on a bill I have and come right back. So don't say anything important while I'm gone, will you?
I might not say anything important for 2 hours.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Please introduce yourself.
Very good. Chair Greenlick, members of the House Healthcare Committee, my name is Barney Spate. I am currently a special advisor to Dr. Goldberg at the Oregon Health Authority, and also am supporting the governor's health policy staff in ACA implementation in the commercial market, basically coordinating work between Cover Oregon, Oregon's Health Exchange, the DCBS Oregon Insurance Division, and the Health Authority. That's who I am and what I do. I've been invited here today to give an overview of the components of the Accountable Care Act that relate to the individual, private individual market and the small group market, to talk about some implications. I'm going to give a little background about how the individual market works today, what the reforms do in the individual market. And the implications of some of these and some of the mitigating initiatives. I want to briefly talk about two bills that relate to the implementation in the commercial market that this committee will be hearing in the near future. And then talk briefly about the small group market, particularly if there's time. So let me start with, how does the current individual market operate? Because I think it's an important foundational piece to fully understand exactly what the reforms that will be implemented in 2014, January 1, 2014, do to the individual market. The current individual market, one of the underlying premises to make the market as it is constructed today operate is medical underwriting. That is, persons file a health statement when they apply for coverage. And in Oregon, they can either be accepted for coverage or they are rejected for coverage for reasons of pre-existing conditions or other diagnostic issues that place them in some sort of high-risk category. So the pool, the current individual market pool in Oregon, across the marketplace totally and at the carrier level, is a pool that basically reflects people who were medically underwritten and did not have pre-existing conditions. That doesn't mean that once somebody is in the individual market and they become ill or are diagnosed with a disease, they can continue to keep their coverage. It's renewable, et cetera. Another aspect of the current market is coverage. What's covered by the policies, the various policies issued in the state, it can vary. For example, some of the research that's been done in looking at what the implications of introducing ACA in Oregon, approximately 23% of the members in current individual coverage do not have RX coverage, do not have prescription drug coverage, and another 3% have only generic only. 18% of the members in plans have no mental health or substance abuse coverage. Another 18% have no mental health, but they do have coverage, but they do have substance abuse coverage. And only 18% have full mental health parity. So you can get a sense that in today's market, what carriers can put together relative to what's covered and what people want to buy is pretty non-prescriptive in many ways. And lastly, I think you're probably all aware that there's a wide choice of cost-sharing options in the individual market. I went on just as I was preparing for this presentation and looked at two or three companies, and you can get deductibles from $1,000 to $2,000, $5,000, $7,500, $10,000 deductible with fairly high out-of-pocket costs. A couple of other aspects about the individual market currently is that it represents about 10% of the private health insurance market. That's 10% of persons who are either insured by group coverage, insured or self-insured coverage, or have coverage such as portability or some other private coverage. Oregon is also distinguished in its current market that we have a very competitive marketplace. Seven domestic carriers insure about 85% of the market, and I've listed the carriers here in alphabetical order. In some states, it's very common to have only three or less carriers dominating the individual market. So this competition, we're anticipating that in January of 14 will continue. I think that Rocky King and others that have testified before the committee on Cover Oregon have disclosed to you that I think 16 companies have expressed interest in participating in the exchange beginning in January. So I would anticipate that the marketplace in 2014 and beyond in Oregon will continue to be competitive like it is now. So let's look at a little bit of what does it mean to have a medically underwritten market. And this gets back to my earlier comment about when you apply for coverage in the individual market, fill out a health statement, and you are either accepted for coverage or rejected. These statistics are from the Department of Consumer and Business Services Insurance Division for 2012, and show the number of applications that are received by all of the companies in Oregon. For the year, about 80,000, a little over 80,000 applications were received by all licensed carriers in Oregon in the individual market, and about 21%. Interesting enough, about 4,000 people a quarter were denied coverage. So that 16,000, close to 17,000 folks who one assumes when they applied were ready to buy private coverage but could not get coverage because of some underwriting issue that barred them from getting coverage. In Oregon, another aspect of the Oregon health environment and the health financing environment.
Barney,
yes.
Could you do you want to take some questions as we
go
along?
Yeah, I can stop this as we go along.
Representative
go
Parker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very quick question. What's the evidence that you have that those are not the same 4,000 people applying?
I have no evidence that they're not the same 4,000, but given intuitively, given both the nature of the application process, that mm-hmm. if there is duplication, it's probably relatively small.
Okay.
But that's an excellent question.
You're pretty sure about that?
Well, I know that it's...
I'm not arguing that they are the same.
I know that filling out the health statements and filling out the applications generally is you know, it's a long process for an individual. And in many cases, individuals may be working through an agent or broker and helps them fill it out the first time, and they get it. You know, because if they're working through a broker, many times the broker can actually tell them whether he thinks they qualify or not.
Okay.
Is that
good enough for now? Yeah, thank you.
In Oregon, we have a high-risk pool. We've had a high-risk pool in this state for decades. It's one of the... I think one of the best high-risk pools in the nation, primarily because relative to our size, the size of our individual market, we've had a very robust high-risk pool, the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. It currently has about 11,120 members as of January. That is down. The high point of enrollment in the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool was a few years ago with about 17,000 members. To get into the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, it's voluntary, but you have to have been rejected for coverage in the individual market. So the pool, if you will, is a safety net to the current individual market, which has medical underwriting. The demographics of the people who are in the pool, about 69% are over the age of 45. It's heavily oriented toward females, 59%, and 61% are under $45,000 a year. In the pool, you have a choice of three medical plans. They are all administered by the same TPA. It's a Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield policies that they're not underwritten by Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield, but they are administered by Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield. And the $750, $1,000, and $1,500 that I've written there are basically the deductible styles that are available, and I can go into more detail if you want. Now, remember, the people that are coming into the Oregon Medical Insurance pool are those who have pre-existing conditions, have illnesses, and so the loss ratio is about 200%. They do pay monthly premiums. The people that are enrolled, they pay premiums. And you can see that the average premium across all the policies, this is a late 2012 data, about $600 in premiums, average premium policy, policy per premium, and the expenses are around $1,434.
Is that based on ability to pay or the 605?
No, it's a set amount based upon age.
Okay.
You pick your plan, you pick your age. It can be a single policy, it can be a family policy, it can be a two-party policy. And but it's not wealth-adjusted.
Okay, and does income play a role in whether or not you're eligible?
No. I will say that, and this may be somewhat dated, I believe this is still the case that it used to be, and I've been a little bit out of touch, but one of the most common reason for people dropping OMIP coverage was affordability. And if you look at kind of the underlying age and demographics of it, the cost of OMIP has gone up, notwithstanding its subsidization.
Barney, can I ask you a question too? What percentage does the state pick up, and what percentage are covered by the premium payments?
Well, that's an excellent question, and I'm going to go right next to it because the state of Oregon does not pay anything into making up that $800 and $829 difference between policy expense and policy premium. That gap is made up by an assessment on the insured market. And the next slide points out that twice a year, the Office of Private Health Partnerships, which administers the OMIP program, places an assessment on the insured population, on the insured carriers in the state. That would be carriers in the individual, small group, large group market, and on reinsurance carriers who are reinsuring self-insured groups. And in 2012, that assessment was about, as indicated, a little over $89 million. The last assessment, again, this is done twice a year, was about $5.09 per member per month. So that's how the pool, if you will, remains fiscally stable. In essence, I guess the message about the current individual marketplace is, in some degrees, it is not a natural market if you think about the fact that there is pre-existing condition limitations. There is a safety net, if you will, but it is the underlying, Oregon has a robust small group membership with over 170,000 members, and it is relatively affordable, but what I'm trying to explain is the underlying affordability for that market right now is skewed by the fact of medical underwriting and the fact that OMIP at least helps some get coverage. And it was viewed consciously when OMIP was created, and I was a young man then, as a way to help backstop the fact that you have to have medical underwriting in a marketplace where you don't have guaranteed issue. And I'll get into this a little bit when I talk about the individual mandate. Any questions? Let me stop there, because now that's kind of where we are today. Now, what I'm going to cover for the next few minutes is what are the reforms that will be implemented, are actually being operationalized even as we speak in Cover Oregon, at the insurance division, in all of the carriers that are in the Oregon market, and others. What are those reforms? What are the major ones? I want to tell you, I'm a policy generalist. I spent a lot of time thinking about what I could. There's 700-800 pages of regulation that seem to come out every other week. Trying to boil this down, that would be really helpful for your background as a policymaker. So it is boiled down. But there are other people around, and if you have questions either today or later that we can get answers for, I'd be very glad to help on that. So the first and most profound change in the individual market in Oregon is guaranteed issue. We already have guaranteed renewability if you have a policy, but starting January 1, a person that applies in the individual market, whether it be through the exchange there will be policies available in the individual market outside the exchange. The carrier that offers those policies has to accept the person without any pre-existing condition limitations, or there's no more rejection based upon health status. So medical underwriting goes away. The cohort to the other side of the guaranteed issue equation is in fact the individual mandate. I want to give a little bit of history. In 2007, 2008, I was the executive director of the Oregon Health Fund Board, and I think you may have recently got an update on, looking back into history, the strategic plan of reform that we looked at and developed, that ultimately came out as House Bill 2009. But in that look in 2007, 2008 with the Health Fund Board, where it was a citizen panel appointed by the governor, we had a subcommittee that looked very extensively about moving away from a medically underwritten individual market to a guaranteed issue market. And the simple equation that I carried away from all of the work we did, and we had carrier actuaries from carriers and agent brokers involved and consumer advocates, is that If we want to get rid of medical underwriting, you have to have guaranteed issue. And if you have guaranteed issue, you have to have a mandate. And if you have a mandate, you have to have a subsidy program so that those who can't afford to abide by, meet the mandate have some assistance in it. And so the reason, the one question that may be top of mind would be, well, why do you need a mandate in an individual market? And it basically has to do with the underlying principle of adverse selection. That if the market is totally voluntary and people come buy insurance or drop insurance at their own will, then you have the phenomena of somebody buying insurance when they need health care, particularly expensive health care, surgery or whatever, and then perhaps dropping that insurance afterwards, and you have a very unstable risk pool in that. And a few states have had guaranteed issue without a mandate. Washington State passed one in 1993, and the individual market, I wouldn't say collapsed. What it did was about 98% of the carriers left because it was a bad financial deal. And other states that have had a guaranteed issue without a mandate, the policies are very expensive and the pool is very small because just the way they have to price it, very few people could afford it. So I think a step forward relative to the individual market is guaranteed issue, but one of the underlying other side of this is the need for a mandate. So that's the pillar, I think. That's one of the most fundamental changes that really those two, well, the guaranteed issue by itself, I think, fundamentally changes how the market dynamics will work. Some other things about what's different that will be in the individual market. There is this concept called essential health benefits, that the plans that are offered through the exchange and the plans that are offered outside the exchange for both the individual and small group market will have a standard set of benefits, answering the question, what's covered? And so these are the 10 categories of coverage that every plan has to provide. And you'll see, given my earlier comments about mental health and prescription drugs, they are on there. There is flexibility in this for carriers to administer these relative to trading services off and things like this, but there, for the consumers that go to the to cover Oregon to purchase coverage or purchase coverage outside the exchange, they will know that starting in 2014 that the what is covered is standardized across all of the plans that are available.
Barney, can I ask a question?
Yes.
Can you go back there? Talk a little bit about habilitative services as opposed to rehabilitative.
That's very interesting, Chair Greenlick, particularly given your background. It's one of the it's a this is a personal opinion. I think everyone in the Oregon market understands what rehabilitative services are, and we've worked, I know the insurance division and through a Senate Bill 91 committee has worked on this. The concept of habilitative services is new to me. I think it's new in the parlance of a contract, and I think we've added some definitions to be able to begin to define it, but and I'll have to get back to you, but it is a term that seems to be used much more in federal legislation and is not, I would say, typical in the current Oregon market. Now, we've got some folks here with the insurance division that are much more, and I know that Anthony Behrens, who chaired the Senate Bill 91, that there was issues among what is this and how does it differ from rehabilitative?
But my understanding is rehabilitative services, by definition, is a person has a function and they lose that function. They have a stroke,
right.
They have an accident, they have something, they lose that function. So those services are intended an attempt to give back
to the highest level possible,
to the highest level, give back that function. The notion of habilitative services is there are people that never had a function. And these are services that will essentially restore is not the word.
Right.
But improve their functionality in a way that will get them back to where a person who did have that function to its highest possible level. And it's a very interesting concept.
Right. And I know there's around the operational definitions of this, there's been, you know, been a lot of confusion. That's my takeaway.
Thank you.
You've probably all heard, I think, part of the parlance about healthcare reform in this country is we're all understand metallic tiers now. But there will be standardized levels of coverage. If the essential health benefit defines what's covered in a plan, and it's pretty much standardized, the standardized levels of coverage are to give the consumer much more information about, okay, I know what's covered. Now, how much of it will the insurance company pay, and how much will I pay on average? And so there are four levels, bronze, silver, gold, and platinum. And the bronze is the bronze level plans. When the exchange opens, and in January 14, the non-exchange individual policies that are available outside the exchange will be in one of these four categories. Bronze being, if you will, the cheapest, because on average, actuarially, a bronze plan is expected to cover about 60% of the expected costs for an average individual.
And that's both premium and coinsurance.
Actually, it's just coinsurance. I'm going to turn around and ask.
No. Is it just coinsurance?
Yeah, I mean, it's not premium.
It's to meet the expected level of cost claims.
Claims cost.
The plan would pay 60% of those expected costs, either through a complement of co-pays or above the deductible.
Correct.
So it's all in a cost-sharing mechanism.
It doesn't include premium. So the 60% is what the insurance pays. The other way to look at this, if I had a bronze plan, I will pay 40% on average. That 40% would be deductibles, co-pays, co-insurance, and then all these policies have out-of-pocket max that when you hit the max, then it's 100% coverage after that. Is that, you have a look that's not helpful?
No, well, it's very helpful. It's just a bit surprising. I mean, the insurance policy covers 60%. You're going to cover 40%.
On average.
On average. And the premium is to pay for what? For the
60%? Premium is to pay for the 60%.
Right.
For the average risk of those policies. And let me, let me give you a reference point. The action, I didn't say this at the time because I hadn't even used the term actuarial value. So now that I probably have you concerned, but the 60% is known as an actuarial value. On average, that's what the policy should cover for the average individual.
So the notion is you're paying 100% of the cost, and you're paying it in two ways. You're paying the premium, which covers 60%, and your coinsurance is going to cover the other 40%.
Right. And as you move up these metallic tiers, your premium will rise because more of the anticipated economic burden in the policy is covered by the insurance company. And what I wanted to reference is that we through a study commissioned by the insurance division, the actuarial values in the current individual insured market run from a low of 37% actuarial value to 92%. Now, what that means is that if you have a policy with a 37% actuarial value, it's probably a very high deductible policy, where what you're really doing is insuring the catastrophic coverage over $10,000 or even higher. So all of the policies will be in one of these areas. There's also in Oregon a requirement. This came.
Hold on a second. Was that alignment?
So I have a question. So you talk about the areas, and I understand the premium pays for the coverage. But so within these areas, will those premiums be set then so that whoever buys that, so if they buy the bronze plan where they get 60% of the coverage, then that premium, regardless of all the existing or pre-existing condition, that the premium amount will be set for everybody?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lively, know that what will happen, and it's probably easiest to explain it from the point of view of the exchange. I go to the market, I look at prices, I say, okay, I'm interested in a bronze plan. I understand what the deductibles are, I understand what the 40% that I'm going to be responsible for, and then I will look at the bronze plans that are offered by the carriers that are in that tier, and the price of those policies will vary by how the carrier is looking at managing risk, looking for market share. Mm-hmm. So the consumer will be able to, one, look at price comparisons for policies that are quite similar in both what is covered and in an actuarial value. One of the things I want to point out with actuarial value, though, is that let's take a bronze plan. You can have lots of different variations in how that 40% cost that I bear is distributed. So you could have a bronze plan that's got a $2,000 deductible but a 70% coinsurance, or you could have another one with a higher deductible and a lower coinsurance. So there's going to be variability. They will all be in that 60% range, but it also will allow consumers to decide, based upon their own economics, do I want a higher deductible, and then when I do get sick, have a more comprehensive copay. But each of the plans that are there, regardless of how that cost sharing is distributed, will be reviewed by the insurance division and certified that it falls within a range. I think it's a plus or minus two or three of a 60% bronze.
But Barney, I think where Live is going, at least where it pushed me. We get an actuarial estimate of it, and we have to believe that actuarial estimate for operation purposes. So the actuarial estimate says, here's what 40% is that's not covered. You're going to buy a premium for the other 60% of that actuarial value, plus some administrative costs, I think. Why should there be any difference in prices if you believe the actuarial value?
Well, the underlying prices are going to be a function at the carrier level of a couple of things. One, the nature of the networks and contracts they have with providers that they pay to provide those services.
But they're covering 60% of the risk. I mean, the expectation is...
But carrier A and carrier B might have totally different arrangements with providers. So the actual cost of the same risk could, in fact, vary based upon the provider network. It could also vary based upon I mean, the actuarial science is, you know, it's a science, but there's also art that goes into pricing products. So there will be variability based upon the, if you will, the competitiveness of the market.
So we can get back to this later.
Okay. I think I know where you're going.
Mr. Chair, I actually have a question I think is appropriate here, and it's because you're talking about actuarial estimates of cost. Will it be possible, will the actuarial projections or the estimates of cost be based on the whole pool in the exchange, or will insurers maybe randomly or maybe by intent be able to end up cherry-picking lower risk and thereby having a competitive advantage on pricing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Conger, very good question. I do cover it a little later, but I think now's a good time to put it into context.
I apologize.
No, that's fine. I think this is an excellent way to get the discussion about this. The pools for carriers that are operating in the individual market, whether they're in the exchange or outside of the exchange, they will be a single rating pool. So everybody that's, let's say, Carrier A has some products that are in the exchange. Carrier A may also have some products they offer that are outside the exchange. They will offer. If they are in the exchange, it will be offered outside the exchange if they want to be outside the exchange. They can also have other products that are not in the exchange. But the underlying pool of risk that that carrier is managing will be reflected across the pricing of all of those products. So there is one pool. There's similarly one pool for the small group. And it's in both inside and outside the exchange. And I think it's very important to understand the single pool as a way to hopefully stop the kind of dynamic of a carrier being outside the exchange with a different pooling mechanism and carriers that are inside the exchange and being able to, if you will, have the price reflect the whole book of business. Very good question.
Thanks.
But the extent to which they'll try and cherry pick with the benefit design.
Well, Mr. Chair, there will be probably some new subtleties in benefit design, but I would the essential health benefit does not eliminate variation in benefit design completely, but it certainly makes a much more standardized underlying benefit available to everybody. And I would just point to the mental health and prescription drug as examples. Now, the other side of this, quite candidly, is there are people who say in today's market, I want to buy a policy without prescription drugs. In January of 2014, they won't be able to do that. If they buy a policy, it's going to have prescription drugs.
Go ahead, Bernie.
Chair, other question?
Okay.
I guess a piece that's still not clear in my mind is, so what is the individual responsibility for that 40%? You said on average it would be about 40%, but it could be 50%, 80%, 10%. I don't quite understand why that's variable. Why isn't it a specific amount? I mean, you know, I pay $6,000 and then I paid my full deductibles and never.
Let me do this slide, Representative Kenner, and see if it helps to answer that question. Because in addition to those actuarial value tiers, there are some maximum cost sharing standards that are imposed. And so, regardless of the tier or the policy you buy, the maximum out-of-pocket can be no higher than $6,500 a year for an individual. And these are rough. These are pretty close, or $13,000. And what that means is that whether you're looking at the 40%, you know, the 40% of bronze, the 50% of silver, et cetera, is that if you don't use your policy, if you buy a bronze policy and are not sick, well, there's no 60% paid by the carrier and no 40% paid by the insurer. But the 40% on average is looking at what does the average person, are they expected to spend for, you know, average health status. But even if their health status is kind of more than the average, it is protected with this out-of-pocket maximum.
On an annual basis.
Thank you.
But the out-of-pocket does not include the cost of their premiums.
That's correct.
On top of this. So when a person looks at the total cost.
Right.
Right.
Right. Okay. We've covered kind of the contract, the benefit design, the economic, the obligations between the carrier and the insured. And now another big part of the ACA reforms that will be coming have to do with rating. And this is how rating, again, I'm a layperson, rating relates to how do carriers actually develop their the prices that they put on their products. To Representative Conger's comment, there is a single risk pool. Let me point out that a carrier could decide to only play in the exchange and not to have policies offered outside the exchange. A carrier that has policies in the exchange and they want to be outside the exchange, they have to offer those same policies. But they can also offer other policies because there are a limit on the number of policies each carrier can offer and cover Oregon. Alternatively, there's another option, and that is a carrier can decide not to be in the exchange at all and to be sell only outside the exchange through the classic marketing, advertising, agent brokers, et cetera. Those policies, though, all have to be ACA compliant. They have to meet the bronze, the bronze, silver tiers. They have to meet the essential benefits, et cetera. But anyway, the single pool, as I described earlier, unifies all of that risks, and the risk is distributed across all of those policies, regardless of exchange or not. Then the ACA also puts into place what is known as modified community rating. It limits the number of factors that a carrier can use to change a base rate. The easiest to understand is family size. That is, a policy for one person is of less cost than a policy for two people, or a husband and wife, two-party with children. So family size is permissible.
And Barney, just to point out, there's two different things. You have community rating or experience rating. And this is modified community rating. Experience rating says, here's what your experience was last year. Here's what your premium is going to be next year based on it. By talking about modified community rating, it doesn't look at experience. It only looks at underlying factors.
I think I want to qualify that. It looks at the experience in the pool.
That's right.
It's the pooled experience,
but not the individual.
But not the individual.
Absolutely.
Or in the case of small group, it looks at the experience in the small group pool, not the group per se. And then you take that underlying experience and you can modify it based upon these factors. The next one would be geography. There is a variability in cost. Of course, we realize that in the country, but there's also a variability in cost just within the state. There are only two carriers currently, the information I have, there are only two carriers that use geographic adjustments. The remainder have a single statewide rate for everything. But their geographic rating is permissible. Oregon has predefined geographic areas that were established by the insurance division. And so a carrier uses the geographic rating, they will have to develop their actuarial work and have it approved consistent with those with that geography. The next area, age, is I want to point out if one of the big profound changes was getting rid of medical underwriting, and that will have an impact on cost. I'll get into cost here in a little bit. The next one to watch and be able to understand is age rating will be changing in Oregon in the individual market. Now, what age rating really means is, and the requirement is that the rate you charge an older person can be no more than three times the rate you charge a younger person. It's called a 3-to-1 ratio for age. It's a way of spreading because older people have naturally higher cost. A pure community rate, to Representative Greenlick's earlier comment, a pure community rate would be there's one rate for everybody regardless of your age. The recognition of an age rating recognizes that the costs of as you get older, as we get older, our medical costs are higher. When we're younger, they're not that high. How do we get some equity so that policies are affordable when you're young, but also not so unaffordable when you're old? Now, the research that's been done in anticipation of the ACA implementation in Oregon is that the carrier, the natural being in the sense that the carrier decides what their age rate is, are estimated to be 3.3 to 1. So that would be a carrier that's really pretty close to the 3 to 1 age band, and others at up to 5.2 to 1. And what that means is that when you change that age slope from 5 to 3, that this is the elderly and this is the young. The elderly's rates come down, but to be revenue neutral, the younger rates have to come up.
All under 64.
This is between the ages of 21 and 64. And the feds, the HHS has prescribed a fixed 3 to 1 age slope, they call it. It will be uniform across all the carriers. Through technical work groups with instituted by the insurance division, there's actual consideration of should Oregon have its own unique 3 to 1 age band, so that technically all of this would be different than the feds. We've reached the conclusion, or the experts have reached the conclusion, that right now there doesn't seem to be a lot of a need to do that. Time's of the essence, etc. So I'll get a little bit later when I talk about the cost impacts. I want you to recall this change in age.
May I ask a question about the age? This is for the individual policies. I thought Oregon had, for small group, I thought there was already a rule around pricing or adjusting premiums within the small group based on age.
It is, and I believe we're on our way to a 3 to 1. Are we not? Is it?
We have a rule, but it's...
Why don't you join? If Arnie's going to ask you, why don't you come up and identify yourself?
This is Laura Calley. I'm glad she's joining me. She's smarter than I am.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. So for the record, my name is Laura Calley. I'm the Chief Actuary and the Manager of Product Regulation for the Insurance Division. And to answer your question, Representative Conger, the way that it works right now in the small group market is after consideration of all rating factors, so age, geography, family composition, and there's also participation and other factors that are considered, the rate that is charged for the group can be no higher or lower than 50% either direction of the average rate. So it basically does that 3 to 1 around all the factors combined, not just age. So it's actually more restrictive than what the federal standard is going to imply for small group.
Would you try that one more time?
Pardon me.
He looked puzzled and I felt puzzled.
I always look puzzled though.
So right now, let's try just two factors to be simple. So if you have a small group, you are going to go through and rate all the individuals based on their ages. And right now, you in small group, you may have a carrier who has a 5 to 1 ratio for their age slope, right? So they go through, you've got variation from that 1 to 5 range. You then overlay onto that you may actually have members within your small group that are in different geographies, and you actually are going to apply those geographic factors. And then at the end of the day, you say, well, what are the resulting rates for each of the people in the group? And you convert that all to an average rate because the group all pays a same average rate. That average rate that's charged to the individual members after all of the rating factors, both age and geography, cannot be more than 50% higher. So if you're, let's say your average rate for that group would have been $100. You can't charge more than $150 for that group. That's the cap. On the flip side, it can't be lower than 50% less than that. So you can't charge less than $50. So it compresses the impact of all the factors to that 3 to 1, whereas the federal law requires that just the age be within that 3 to 1. So it's a little more restrictive the way it is now in Oregon.
Just a comment about that. Having a different standard for the exchange in small groups versus everybody else in the exchange, I am going to guess complicates the job of the exchange and the providers who are putting up the, you know, the pricing and the policy offerings and everything else. Would there be a benefit to the state of making them, making those standards the same?
This is all market-wide, so it applies to both policies inside and outside the exchange. All of these factors do.
But not the individual small group, that's what you're saying. Those are two very different markets.
Well, you mean, were you talking about merging the pools of the individual and small group?
I was not even saying merging the pools. That would be a whole other leap further. But I'm saying applying the same
in
rating
out, in
system
out,
in small group,
and, small group
and in the rest of the exchange pool. It just strikes me that this is enormously complicated, and we make it more complicated by having a different standard for one set of policies that we're offering in the exchange versus another.
Let me try again, and if I get this wrong, Laura will correct me. But the development of rates for small group in the exchange will be the same methodology that's used for the development of rates outside the exchange.
No, he's talking about small group in the exchange and individual in the exchange.
In the exchange, exactly.
He's talking about why can't we have the same rules for those two markets.
Having two different sets of rules inside the exchange. I just wonder, I mean, we're spending an awful lot of money developing this tool, and I know this is a digression, and I'll stop, but it occurred to me that the more complicated we make the pricing and everything else within the exchange, the more we have to spend on developing a system that accommodates it. And Rocky has tried to explain it to me a couple of times, and my eyes crossed, and, you know, I kind of lost him after the first three words. So anyway, I'm just wondering if there's a way that we could, you know, change the policy so that inside the exchange, we're using the same methodology, the same rating methodology, so that it simplifies things for the exchange. And I would think it would.
A layman's comment, and then I would love to have Laura offer a more professional, is that there is a fundamental difference between developing a price in the individual market and a group market where you have more than one, well, you have multiple employees and multiple family dependents.
I understand that.
And I think that's one of the differentiating factors. But is that a fair?
I would agree with that. And then you also factor in that employers decide, you know, how to contribute toward their employees' coverage. That's a factor as well.
Okay. Thanks.
Go on, Bernie.
Okay, the last. You can
stay.
Sit here.
All right.
No, stay, yeah.
I will.
Makes me feel more comfortable. And the last one is the use of tobacco. And that is the carrier can adjust a rate based on a person's use of tobacco, and they are developing rules on what does tobacco use mean and how that would be applied.
Can I ask one more question about that?
Yes.
Who decides the geographical boundaries? The insurance division?
The insurance division has, and because there has been the ability for geographic rating in Oregon prior to ACA, and I believe there are seven regions that have been defined by the state, and so if a carrier, and the geography is an option, they don't have to do that, but if they do, if you do geographic rating, it has to be done consistently according to the regions as defined by the insurance division.
The same rating with existing rating factors for the different regions?
Well, I think the rating factors are, in fact, have to be actuarially justified by the difference in the underlying costs between the regions, because right now there are different geographic factors. By the two companies that I mentioned that use geography, they use different factors, but that reflects, I think, their underlying cost patterns between these regions, which gets probably into provider contracting costs, things like that. Okay.
Mr. Chair, one more question.
I'm still struggling. So the 1.5 would translate to what percentage increase in the premium amount?
It's it's 50%.
50%? Or
50%.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So it's really dramatic. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And again, it's at the carrier's option. They can pick something less than 1.5, but the application of whatever they pick, there are definitions that have to be standardized about, you know, how long have you smoked, or if I've quit, how long have you quit, that kind of thing.
if I may add, yeah, the, actually HHS has defined tobacco use very clearly about, you know, the frequency and the duration of use. And what they also have allowed, and we don't know if carriers will choose to do this, that 1.5 is a maximum. So carriers can do a smaller differential, so it could be 10% if they wanted. It also can vary by age. So they can charge older smokers more than younger smokers, for example.
Okay, another aspect of the reform is that in addition to, we've talked a lot about the standardizing of plans in the exchange, in the market generally, individual and small group market, with essential health benefits, with standardized tiers, with a more standardized rating. In addition to all of those, there is permitted under the reforms a catastrophic plan. The catastrophic plan is available under federal regulation to persons who are under 30 or to persons who are exempt from the mandate due to a financial hardship. And that's generally that they can't get a policy for that's under 8% of their family income. The catastrophic plan is, in fact, what a catastrophic plan is supposed to be. It covers all of the essential health benefits, but it has a deductible, and this is an approximation, has a deductible of approximately $6,500. And then there's 100% coverage after that. And then it requires that there's 3 primary visits each year before the deductible and no cost sharing for some specified preventive health services. This product in Oregon, by state statute, the catastrophic coverage, is only available to persons who are qualified to buy it through carriers that are in the exchange. And this was a conscious policy decision that was made when Senate Bill 99 was passed that developed the exchange. It basically does 2 things. The reason Oregon has that, and we consciously made that decision, all of you did, was to make certain that we want to encourage carriers to be in the exchange, and we also wanted to encourage that younger good risk, even though it's catastrophic, the premiums are less, to be in the pool of those carriers that are in the exchange. If somebody qualifies for a catastrophic coverage, they do not otherwise qualify for any of the premium credits that I'll get into in a few minutes, and other helping with cost sharing.
This must be a really pretty cheap premium.
Well, Laura May, I've read one piece from a recent article in the Kaiser Family Foundation that estimated that this policy could be 25% cheaper than the bronze. It's intended to be, and Massachusetts, when it did its universal coverage bill several years ago, they had a catastrophic plan for young people. It's really intended to help get young people affordable coverage that they don't perhaps want as much coverage, but to get them in, and it's a, quite candidly, it's an easier economic burden to fulfill the mandate. And I think in the marketing that you will be seeing later in the year from Cover Oregon and others, there will be a real push to educate the younger consumer, particularly those that have coverage now, but also those that don't have coverage now, about at least having minimal catastrophic coverage for really high cost events like a serious illness or an accident or something like that. Okay. I'll have a few more comments on catastrophic a little later. So now, financial assistance with costs of coverage. There are two basic ways that folks get financial assistance if they buy insurance through the exchange to fulfill their obligations of meeting the mandate. The first is a refundable and advanceable premium credit. I know you're really anxious to look at some of this, and I've got some examples coming, so I just want to forewarn you. I'm going to walk you through some of this so that you at least get a one perspective of how it works. But these advanced premium credits are available to people between 100% and 400%. You got to essentially say between 138 and 400%. And this helps with it reduces their out-of-pocket costs on a monthly basis for premium. Then there is another program, cost-sharing subsidies, and these are available to, for persons that are below 250% of the federal poverty level, and this subsidy program helps them with the cost-sharing, so that if they bought a bronze plan, for example, and they were below 250% of the plan, they would actually have less out-of-pocket costs than they would otherwise have. It's estimated, and this was an estimate made by some consultants working for Oregon, that these two programs, as they are applicable to people who qualify for them, would have an estimated impact of decreasing average individual market member out-of-pocket costs by 23%, and this would be a combination of both premium cost and cost-sharing cost. The advanceable premium credit helps with funding, paying for the premium, and the cost-sharing subsidies help with the out-of-pocket costs that are incurred when an insured person uses the plan.
Barney, this is all in the individual market?
These are in the individual market only. When I get into the small group market, I'll talk about some tax credits that are available to small group purchasers. So let me spend a minute, and this was good exercise for me because I never really figured out, and I hope I got it right, but there will be people listening that if I don't get it right, they'll call you. The premium tax is pegged off of the second lowest cost silver the plan in the exchange in the area in which the person lives. So remember, we have bronze, silver, gold, and platinum. So think of the exchange serving the Salem area. And let's say we have 10, 15 carriers, each with a number of silver plans. There, you could have choice of, 40, 50 plans. Looking at the price for that year, the second lowest silver plan, and they call it the silver reference plan, becomes the base. The cost of that plan becomes the base against which tax credits are calculated for that year. So then you take off the maximum monthly premium, and I've got a slide that comes, and I'll show you how this works. So my maximum monthly premium is a function of my family income. So we have a fixed base for the cost of the plan, the silver reference plan. There's a calculation that's made based upon my income of what my maximum monthly premium is, and you subtract the maximum monthly premium, and that's equal to the refundable advanceable premium tax that's paid by Treasury to the carrier on a regular basis. Now, if I want to buy a more expensive plan or a less expensive plan, I can do that. But I will never get more than my maximum monthly premium contribution. So let me give you an example here. And let's just look at, let's say that at 200%, the maximum premium for somebody at 200% cannot exceed 6.3% of their income. And this is using, this will be kept current by federal poverty level statistics every year. This is an example from the Congressional Research Service using, I think, 2010 data. But it's for illustrative purposes, it gives you the same idea. So at 6.3% for one person, I would have to pay no more than $114 that's my maximum allowable contribution. And of course, it goes up with family size, and it goes down. And your maximum contribution rises up to the 400%. So let me give a couple examples. This was helpful for me. And again, this is all hypothetical. Let's say that the silver reference plan costs $400, and let's say that the maximum premium. I forget when I did 183. So I did 250%. So this 183 would be something. Oh, it's up at the top. One person at 250% of the poverty level, I'd get a premium tax credit of $183 against that $400 premium, and the tax credit would be $217. And I would have to pay 183, of course. Now, an alternative, let's say I picked a different plan, a different silver plan. It doesn't have to be a gold. Let's say we've got a number of silver plans, and this was to earlier conversation, is that they may be priced differently based upon how the carrier arrived at their rates. But let's say for some reason I picked a $435 plan because it had a better network or a bigger network or whatever. I still get the $217 credit, but now I have to pay $218 instead of $183 because of the $35 is now on my is on my back. That's how the premium tax credit works. Let me stop there before I go to the mandate to give you a little more back. Are there any questions about? So there will be, and there's lots of them out there now that are in you know, exemplary, but there will be.
Can you talk about how the co-insured works in that same case?
Well, the person buys the policy, they're paying $183 a month. Treasury is paying to the carrier $217 a month. If it's a silver plan, then it's a 70% actuarial policy. How the actual deductible and co-insurance and co-pays vary, it can vary by plan, but it won't.
But this is an example of a 250%. So they don't get a co-insurance subsidy. But if they did, how would the co-insurance subsidy work?
Okay. Let me back up. Cost sharing subsidies.
Right. For under 250. Let's say that's 150% of the cost.
The way they work, and this is a generalist statement, is that I buy a plan, let's say I buy the silver plan, but because my income, let's say it's at 150%, I buy a silver plan, which remember at 70%. If I apply and am eligible for the cost-sharing subsidy and I'm at 150%, the actuarial value that I will actually incur if I use the plan will be at 87%. The carrier will adjust the out-of-pocket to recognize that I have a lower obligation than what my plan that I bought. Now, don't ask me how they're going to do this.
But it's going to, rather than having a 30% copay, you might have a 15% copay.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the less wealthy you are, the greater the cost-sharing impact will have, so that if you're at between 100 and 150%, let's say at 138 and 150, your actual cost-sharing subsidy would raise your actuarial value up to about 94%. It would actually be above, if you will, the platinum plan. So again, it's recognizing premium costs and cost-sharing costs based upon income. This, does that make sense?
And Bernie?
Yes.
People at all levels can choose any plan?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. There'll be multiple plans within each.
They can.
I think there is a little bit of a difference, though, actually, when you have the cost-sharing subsidies. I believe if you're under 250% of the federal poverty level and want to get those subsidies to help offset cost-sharing, I think you have to purchase at least the silver plan. So I don't think you can purchase a bronze plan and then get the subsidies on the cost-sharing side. So that's, I think, the only restriction there.
For which income level?
That's under 250% where you're eligible for a cost-sharing subsidy.
You have to be at least silver.
Yes.
Right. Otherwise, if you didn't peg it to some amount, you could have a really extensive tax credit for a cheaper plan, and then the cost-sharing would, you know.
It just feels like it bumps from the catastrophic to the silver without offering the in-between.
Let's talk a minute about the mandate. I talked about it earlier regarding why it's necessary to go to guaranteed issue. There are exemptions for the mandate. I've listed some of them here. I had a couple, and I'm on the family income. If your threshold for filing taxes, if your family income is below the threshold for filing federal income tax, you're not subject to the mandate. And currently, that's a roughly about $10,000 per year for the individual, or $20,000 for a family. If you can demonstrate that you have to pay more than 8% of income for health insurance, you're not, and that's after the employer contributions or tax credits. I would also note that there are provisions that if you are without coverage for less than 3 months, mm-hmm. You're not subject to any penalties. And then there is a general hardship exemption that one can apply for. I don't know the specifics, but I think the rules will be through HHS for general hardship. The issues about the individual mandate is that the programs in the individual market will have open enrollment, not unlike Medicare D or Medicare Advantage. Open enrollment for the first year will begin October 1 of this year, and I think closes through March, first 3 months, so it's a 6 months open enrollment. Like Medicare programs, there will be open enrollments annually. And then there will be qualifying events where somebody has a qualifying event, they can enroll. For example, they lose group coverage. Or there's a divorce. I can't remember all of the qualifying events, but those are examples of you can get coverage through the exchange outside of the normal open enrollment. This approach to open enrollment and qualifying events hopefully will mitigate the people who will move in and out of the exchange, are willing to take a penalty but want to buy coverage when they know they need a carpal tunnel surgery and then drop the coverage. It slows down some of that movement of in and out of the adverse selection.
Are any undocumented eligible for the subsidy in the exchange?
No.
So you obviously don't need to buy it if they're not eligible.
Right.
But they can buy insurance in the exchange, right?
They can buy insurance.
Maybe not.
I know they can buy insurance in the private market.
Yeah,
but probably not in the exchange because they have to come in through that same entry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there is an issue about coverage in this, but
Mr. Chair? I'm just trying to think how you would stop them from buying in the exchange. I mean, we have over 60,000 on the Medicaid right now.
Not undocumented.
No, we don't.
Not undocumented.
That's nonsense. They come in, they're undocumented, they're not eligible for Medicaid.
Because the thing is, they have Social Security number.
They're not eligible for Medicaid if they're undocumented. That's one of the...
Representative Widener, what I'll do is let me get back to you, to the committee in writing, about how operationally the undocumented... Because, I mean, there will be questions and screenings going on. There's got to be approaches that at least begin to answer it. I can't answer it today.
Because
it's a joint single screening for Medicaid and for the exchange.
Yes. I mean, the processes that will be used when a person, fill out their application for coverage through the exchange, and Rocky and others can, that information goes back to HHS, it goes to Treasury, I believe it goes to Homeland Security. There is a full kind of federal screening of folks relative to their eligibility for particularly the premium tax and perhaps general eligibility. I don't have the details of that.
We'll get back on that one.
Quite certain there's undocumented people on the Oregon Health Plan right now.
Well, we'll put that question to the OHP people, but it's my understanding that undocumented people don't qualify for the health plan.
So the other side of the mandate is what coverage actually satisfies the mandate. These are the, if you're on Medicare, of course, Medicaid or CHIP, which would be in this state would be the Oregon Health Plan. If you have TRICARE coverage, you're a service member or retiree or a family of a service member. Veterans health programs, employer-sponsored insurance, of course. And this includes COBRA coverage. COBRA coverage does not go away. You can still have COBRA coverage and retiree coverage. Self-purchase coverage, as long that is an individual product, whether you bought it in the exchange or outside the exchange, as long as it meets the minimum bronze actuarial value, or alternatively, if you have catastrophic coverage under the under 30, or and then grandfathered plans, and I'm really glad that Laura's sitting here, because I'm going to give you a general definition of grandfather plans, and you can ask questions of her. But when the Act was passed, there was provision that allowed for in both individual and the group market for plans that are in existence on March 13th, 2010, could be grandfathered. That is, those plans could continue, not subject to the ACA, as long as there were no changes to those plans, and I don't believe they could continue to be marketed. And so there are, and Laura probably answered this question, in the state, some individual and small group plans that are in a grandfathered status. They can stay there. The members that are enrolled can continue to have that contract recognized and be paid for, but it is not an active product in the market. Is that a fair description?
That is fair. It can't be marketed any longer. I do not have exact figures with me as to how many enrollees are still on grandfathered plans. We can get that for you. But Barney is correct that those plans were grandfathered in, provided they didn't change, although I believe they did have to comply with certain aspects of the ACA with respect to some of the preventive benefits.
And the, I think the 26, the dependent up to 26,
correct,
which was implemented prior to 14, I think that affected all plans. So those are the coverages that satisfy the mandate. So that gets to the question of, okay, what happens if I just disregard? There are penalties. For 2014, it's the greater of $95 per adult and $47.50 for a child, up to a $285 max for the family, or 1% of family income. So, and it's
easier. Is less.
Yeah, for the penalty. So if I have a family coverage, if I have a family, I pay the penalty. It will be proportionate based on the number of children. That penalty increases over time. And I think the important one is, remember, it's the greater of. So it's 1% of family income in 2014, 2% of family income in 2015, and 2.5% of family income in 2016. And thereafter, that formula will be adjusted by cost of living. Now, one of the issues that I think probably many of you have heard over will the penalties have the appropriate effect of really getting people to buy insurance and stay covered? I think there's real concerns in the first year because they are relatively small. But the policy perspective was to start slow and get them higher. This will be, I think, kind of a health services research question to watch and see exactly who pays the penalty and who doesn't and how effective they are. Just for background, in Massachusetts, it's less than 1% of the tax filing population in Massachusetts pays a penalty. And that's partly because, and I don't have the statistics, there's some take-up statistics that basically say there's a large number of uninsured people who, through these various exemptions, will not be subject to a penalty and then can, in fact, stay uninsured without a penalty.
So, Mr. Chair?
Yep.
So the penalty, what if they don't pay the penalty? Is the penalty collected out of their taxes if they don't file taxes? I'm trying to understand. We create all of this, and of course it's an incentive, but then we create another on the other side, so if they don't pay it?
They don't file taxes, they're exempt.
Right.
If they don't file taxes, they're exempt. If they do file taxes, the IRS will have a program that will indicate. I think you'll probably be asked questions when you file. You may have certificates that have to be filed electronically, et cetera, showing your times of coverage. There will be a way to kind of enforce this. I don't have all the details, but it will probably, I know the penalties will be collected by the IRS through tax filings. let me talk now to topics that are really quite interesting. The implications. There was a report that was commissioned by the state. It's known as the Wakely Report. It was released in July of 2012, and the purpose of the report was to inform the insurance division, the health authority, the governor and all of you as policymakers about what does ACA mean to current market dynamics? What's it do to the cost of coverage? And I'm using the term cost of coverage as opposed to premium increases because it's going to be very difficult to match up premium to premium because we're in two different, we're really in two different paradigms. But I think it's fair to say that the cost of coverage will increase. This table and the aspects of it shows, and this is the 38% that I think is probably in the urban and suburban and rural legend. On average, Wakely estimated that total premium impact before subsidies, before premium tax, premium credits, before cost sharing, on average would be a plus 38%. What I want to point out that I think is an important policy background historically, Mr. Chair, is that look at the morbidity change, that's the 15%, and look at the bottom, the second to the bottom row, individual submarket mergers, that's 22%. What those two numbers represent is, in fact, getting rid of medical underwriting and getting rid of the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. The 15% is just an actuarial estimate.
Portability as well.
Portability is in the submarket merger also. But let me take the 15%. What carriers are going to have to look at with guaranteed issue is, will the health status, will the morbidity of the populations that are going to enroll in my plan, will they be different than they are today with medical underwriting? Well, the answer is yes. This is an estimate on average. It's 15%. That you notice the high was 25%. As a historical note, going back when we had actuaries looking at this, when the state was looking at this through the health fund board, actuaries would say in the same range, somewhere between 15 and 25% because of the health status being different. I will tell you, and this is an important thing to understand about Wakely, this was a snapshot in time based upon the best information that's available. There's been a lot in the literature about, is the uninsured population that comes into the exchange, not necessarily in the first year, but over the first 2 or 3 years, will it actually have a morbidity 15% higher, or will it be much closer? And so this is part of the estimate the carriers are going to have to look at, and that I think there's a lot of research of looking at health status of uninsured folks, et cetera, et cetera.
So, Barney, is that high-risk pool reflected in both the morbidity change and the individual submarket?
No.
Just the...
That's correct, right? Yeah, the individual submarket, the 22%, what that represents is that we have about 11,000. I mentioned 11,000 people in OMIP. Mm-hmm. We have another, 17,000 that are in portability. Portability is a coverage that's offered in the state if you don't have COBRA. Employers provide portability. It's a way for somebody that loses group coverage to continue employer coverage. Again, it's a safety net. Those people, portability will go away. The insurance division, I think, will promulgate rules that portability policies will end because those people now can go to the exchange with or without subsidies. Also in that submarket merger is the FMIP, what we call FMIP, which is the federal high-risk pool that was started. There's about under 4,000 in that. There's a children's reinsurance program that was developed because the elimination of pre-existing condition for kids was instituted prior to 2014, and so this was a pooling. This was a way of providing some protection from that, and I think that's everything, isn't it?
I think Healthy Kids Connect might be in there as well.
Healthy Kids Connect.
And the point is, in both the portability and the high risk and the reinsurance, those are already in insurance premiums now.
Clearly, the assessment for OMIP are in premiums today.
And portability.
Portability is generally subsidized by employers. The other point that why it's 22%, and this is perhaps the irony of having programs like OMIP, is that we know what the health status of those people are. I mentioned the 200% loss ratio. So we understand, because this is a large 11,000 people, we understand what their actuarial costs are going to be, and those folks will come in, be able to choose coverage. As I indicated, currently OMIP has basically one carrier or one carrier's network and three plan designs. They will be able to come to the exchange with guaranteed issue choose the plan and carrier of their choice, and if they qualify for subsidies or cost-sharing subsidies, they will be able to have that. And based upon the income of OMIP, many of them will qualify for subsidies.
So the individual submarket merger are OMIP, FMIP, Portability, Healthy Kids Connect, or the Children's Reinsurance, and those are all markets that you more or less, because they've already in those high-risk pools, you can be fairly accurate about your prediction of 22%. And the morbidity, and so tell me if I'm correct, your morbidity change are the people that are not currently insured that will have to be insured and are not a part of any of those markets. And that perhaps is a little bit harder of a number to predict.
Mr. Chair, I think that's an excellent summary.
Okay. I would agree. Yeah.
I'm going to point out something. You'll see the age slope 3-1.
Barney, can I ask a question before you go?
Yes, sir.
What I heard is, looking at the subsidies and their average impact, much of that 38% will be wiped out for the people who are getting subsidies.
Yes, and a statement that I made early on, Mr. Chair, that I don't have a slide for, but it had to do with the impact. Again, this is in the Wakely report, and I can tease it out for the committee and give it to. But it had to do with it. There's basically a 23% reduction in total cost for those with subsidies and with cost sharing against the cost of coverage. Now, I'm not going to sit here today and there will be cost increases for everybody when you take a medically underwritten pool and open it up to all those that have conditions, someone's going to pay more because the pool's different. There are other, as you can see here, there are other cost drivers in some of the ACA requirements. They're not as dramatic as the merging of the pools or the guaranteed issue. I want to point out, and I think I've got a slide a little later. From the point of view of looking at the market as a whole, the age band has no effect on the market as a whole, but it does have an effect on individuals when they buy insurance. Because if you're in a carrier today with an individual coverage that happens to have, let's say, 4.2-1 age curve, and I'm paying X of that, if it goes to 3.1 and I'm on the lower edge of the age band, my premium is going to go up because of the change in that age curve. But for the market itself, it's neutral. Is that a fair statement?
That is fair.
So real quick, before, because I don't want you to leave this slide, I'm having trouble adding the numbers up, and there must be a massive rounding error or something, either that or...
There is a rounding.
Sure. I missed the point, because like on the high end, 30 plus 20 is 50, not 55.
So these are actually multiplicative. So I think that once you start adding some of the higher percentages, if you add your error will be a little bit less. So what you'd want to do is you'd actually take like the 13%, without getting too mathy, you'd have to take 1.13 times 1.22 to get that 38%. So they're multiplied
by
each other.
I see. So the individual submarket multiply. Okay.
Yeah, they're not additive.
That makes so much more sense.
Yeah, I thought so.
I thought I could add.
It'd be easier that way, wouldn't it?
So this is a slide, again, also from Wakely, that starts to address what Chair Greenlee mentioned, and that is, this is looking at both the currently insured in the individual market and those who and the newly insured, newly enrolled, estimating who will come into the market. These are estimates by income level, and what's where this chart is, I think, is illustrative, is to look at the difference after premium credits, because you can see that the before premium credits, the impact on rates paid, you know, are in the 24 up to 34%. After premium credits, particularly for those from 133 or 138 up to around 250, there will be a substantial offset for those. Now, I think one of the controversies, and I'm just trying to be factual here. One of the controversies or questions, objective questions, is that look at the 400% with 72,747 members that are above 400%, 400% or above, that have individual coverage now. The question is what will happen to those 72,000 members when these reforms take place? One, because they're above 400% of the poverty level, they're not going to get the offsets of premium subsidies or cost-sharing subsidies. If they are older, they will get some relief perhaps in the age band, but if they're younger, all of these will multiply along with the age band. And I think the general concern of the carrier community is what will happen to these people? Will they leave the market and pay the penalty? Those who are under 30, clearly, particularly if they're buying very high deductibles and they're under 30, they can buy the comprehensive plan, which would be the highest deductible I think is available in the market. But that I think is one of the issues that we're going to have to monitor, both from the health policy perspective, from the insurance division's perspective, and I think from Cover Oregon, because it has marketing implications.
But Barney, these people have been complaining about their 20% a year annual rate increases all along. I mean, these are exactly the people we keep hearing from, that Regions raising their rate 27% this year or 18%.
Well, it's going to be probably higher than that, but the one thing is that they're not going to be in a pool with people who are sick. That's part of the reason that the rates are going up. And they're also going to be the age band changes. I mean, these are policy choices that the elderly will pay a little less and the young will pay a little more.
We're not really talking about elderly, Barney.
Well, I'm elderly would be people my age.
Under 65.
Yeah, I'm talking under 65. And really, and Laura can speak more of this.
I don't think these 50 or 64-year-olds.
Really, the age band impacts are in the 40 to 45 and up.
I think we do want to be cautious, because people between 50 and 64 do not consider themselves elderly.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I was wrong.
You zoom past that group.
Okay. So now let's talk about mitigation. And this gets into both some federal mitigation programs and then a couple of the bills I'll talk about that will be coming to this committee. The federal program does establish three programs. Two of them are time-limited, and one of them is permanent. There's a reinsurance. These are the parlance of those who are in the business now. These are the three R's: reinsurance, risk corridors, and risk adjustment. Reinsurance is a three-year program, starts in 2014, runs for 2016. I'll get into the definitions of these. Each one of these will have a slide. Risk corridors, again, a federal program for 3 years. Risk adjustment is a federal program that states can operate on their own, but Oregon has decided, at least at this point, to go with the federal risk adjustment, and it's permanent. It stays in place, and when I walk through a layman's view of risk adjustment, you'll understand why it's permanent and also why it's important over the long haul. So let's look at federal reinsurance. The federal reinsurance program is the parlance that's used in the industry is stop loss. It really is a program that says if an individual that's enrolled with a carrier that has a claims cost above a certain amount, that the federal reinsurance program will come in and help pay for that high cost claim. And it has what's called an attachment point, that is, what's the trigger relative to the claims expense. Then there's a co-insurance, how much will the federal government pay? And then there's a cap on, let's say it's $250,000. This is intended. The purpose of this is, from a national point of view, but also from Oregon's point of view, is to recognize the change in the individual market of moving from medically underwritten to guaranteed issue. And that is, there it is going to be a new pool, and there needs to be some way to mitigate, not erase, but mitigate the impact of this, if you will, profound change. It's funded based on a national assessment of $5.25 per member per month on all insured and all self-insured. That $5.25 declines over 3 years. And it is, it's the actual amount for the federal reinsurance program is fixed at, I think it's $10 billion in the first year. I mean, it's fixed in with a national number. The Wakely report originally indicated, if we go back to the slide, that the impact of the federal reinsurance program in the first year is it would reduce premiums in the individual market by 8%. At the time that report was written, the actual outline of how the federal program would operate was not known. And now we have better information that the federal program will have in the first year, if you think of that just average 38, which was had a minus 8 in it, that minus 8 now is a minus 11. So it will tend to lower the premium impact because this program will help pick up the higher cost claims as people either are moving out of OMIP, in our case, or moving into an insured non-medically underwritten market. So it's to help buffer, if you will, the change that's going on. That's
down
the,
to 35.
Say again?
It's down to 35. Then. The Wakely estimate in the middle. Goes from 38 to 35%.
Well, that's going. Let me go back.
Yeah. Here's because it's minus 8 and this is minus 11.
Yeah, right here.
It takes a 38%
down to minus 9, minus 8, minus 7. I think that minus 8, I would say, is now minus 11, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, which would make the bottom 35.
Yeah, right, okay. Yeah. Now, the risk corridor. The risk corridor is used to mitigate. This is to help a lot of these programs. One of their underlying rationale is to try to improve the actuarial estimate at pricing in the first years as we move from medically underwritten to guaranteed issue. And the federal risk corridor program brings about greater certainty, I don't know to what extent, where the amount of data about what the health cost of enrolled individuals is going to be, and it redistributes profits on a national basis so that carriers who have underwriting margins of better than 97%, they will pay into a federal program. This is on an annual basis, I believe. And for carriers that who have loss ratios above 103%, that is their the premium doesn't cover all the costs, this program will help ameliorate those losses in the first 3 years, and then it goes away. That's about is all I know about this. Then the risk adjustment program is not so much a new. The risk adjustment is used in Medicare Advantage programs. When I was the administrator of the Washington PEB program with about 400,000 public employees, we had risk adjustment with our carriers. It is a way of redistributing premium based upon the risk profile that the carrier actually enrolls. So that if you think after enrollment, if you think that some carrier, and this is looking retrospectively at claims, some carrier attracts the classic example is more diabetics, and therefore the cost of that care relative to the norm is higher than a carrier that attracts a younger, healthier population. This moves premium between those carriers. This is permanent. It's a federal program, but it does help change. It's intended to help change carrier behavior in the sense of trying to reward carriers to take medical risk and to manage it, not try to avoid it. Representative Conger.
May I ask, although I understand exactly what you just said, and it seems very consistent and everything else, I'm wondering, how does that work if you have a more of a managed care type approach, like we do here for Medicaid, but who knows in the future? How does that work if the managed care organization is successful in driving down the cost of care for their population that they're working with. Does that make sense? Does that question make sense?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Conger, makes a lot of sense. And in fact, in my experience, just with a large population like PEB, it was in fact literally to do that. There were, and this doesn't necessarily, I'm using managed care specifically, but some even PPO networks manage health status better than others, and this, if you will, rewards based upon the underlying enrollment characteristics. Even though they may manage it better, they do get some premium reward for attracting and managing those populations. What it really, and
not if you define it by looking at last year's expense rather than looking at underlying characteristics of people on a prospective basis.
Go ahead.
Right, and I would add it's the risk
adjustment that washes that out.
Yeah, and I think to answer your question, it's not based so much on the claims experience. I think to your point, Chair Greenlich, it's not about the claims experience of those people, but it's about the relative risk characteristics. So if you attract all of the higher risks to your network, but you do a better job managing that care, you get to reap the reward of having been, you know, benefited from the risk adjustment program because you're getting those high risks, but you're managing them better. So
that makes sense.
Yeah. So it's a little bit, it operates a little different than the reinsurance program where it really is focused on costs.
Barney, we have 10 minutes. This has been amazing performance. I just want to warn you about the time. We're doing fine.
Okay, just, My keepers have told me that's something I got to talk about here. So,
and you always follow orders. So it's really
yeah, you've known
you and Rocky both. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted, now that we had the context of what's going to go on, I want to put in context. We are proposing, and this the we is it's a multi-stakeholder group, includes carriers, actuaries, other representatives of the companies, the insurance division, other stakeholders, the business community has been involved in this. We are proposing through LC 3718, that's, we have an LC number, we do not have a bill number, the creation of a state supplemental reinsurance program.
We expect that LC in its form will be available Friday for distribution here.
We are hoping. Okay. And the details of that, this is a very high level. It would provide an additional stop loss protection to the carriers in the exchange for claims costs that are associated with persons moving from OMIP, FMIP, children's reinsurance, and portability. So it is targeted at that, if you will, submarket merger population that we know that have high claims cost. It would offer some additional reinsurance program over the same 3-year period that the federal reinsurance program offers. It would be it would be a variation on the current OMIP assessment, but less. And I've got a slide here in a minute. It would also decline over 3 years. And it would sunset after 3 years. And if you recall the minus 11% impact of the federal reform, this state program is estimated to bring the premium down another 4%. So the combined programs of 11 and 4, an estimated 15% range on reducing premiums in the first year. I want to be clear, though, about what these reinsurance programs, they don't make the costs go away. What they really do is they, I was trying to think of, instead of costs going, this the reverse of a cliff. I was told that actuaries don't like cliffs. They deal with slopes. But without the reinsurance programs, all of these changes would have a claims impact on year one just going like that. These 3-year programs tend to put this out so that the costs are built into the underlying premiums over time, and not on one fell swoop. This is a picture of in working with the business community of currently on the far left, the current 2013 assessments, a total, I think that's $11.44. What we're proposing is a $4 assessment. That's the next bar over. The $5.25 I've already mentioned is the federal cost. So those entities that are currently assessed through OMIP would be assessed $9.25 to fund these two insurance reinsurance pools over a three-year period. It would be administered by OMIP. And I think the bill that will be coming before you adds business representatives to the OMIP board. House Bill 2240 is a bill from the insurance division. It's in print, but also there are amendments that are being developed. It does, from a high level, it does several things. It amends the insurance code to align with several of the federal requirements under ACA. It allows the insurance division the authority to make administrative rule changes as guidance and regulations from federal agencies come out. And we're in a very intense period now that Laura and Lou Savage's staff at OID, the Cover Oregon, all of the carriers are looking at rules that are coming out, set 300-400 pages four or five times a week. Lots of reading, lots of thinking about what does all of this mean and how consistent are they. So that will probably continue. It also phases out the Office of Health Partner, Private Partnerships and the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. And those members will transition to Cover Oregon or the Oregon Health Plan. I would note, Rocky and I were both involved in the creation of the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, which is a premium assistance program that was created, I don't know, long time ago. I almost had a full head of hair then, Mr. Chair.
No.
But in many ways, at least the individual market premium assistance concepts are very similar to what the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program was really targeted to do, and that is to try to help modest and working class families be able to afford coverage in the private sector. So more on that from Lou and his staff. Very quickly, the ACA reforms in small group are not as profoundly paradigm-shifting as what I've discussed in the individual market. small group for the purposes of the ACA reforms is defined as groups under 50 for 2014. Under federal law, right now a state could say small group is 100. We had the option in Senate Bill 99. We chose that we would define small group as 50, which is what we define it here in Oregon today. For the first 2 years, and then in 2016, small group will be redefined by federal law and consequently by state law to groups of 100, which means then that groups between 51 and 100 could use the exchange. And then in 2017, states will have the option of deciding through legislative process whether to open the exchange to groups larger than 100. Purchasing through the exchange is optional for small business. There will be, there will be a small group market outside the exchange, and there will be a small group market inside the exchange. Again, the underlying rules and rating will be similar. Pooling will be similar. But if a small group buys in the exchange, it's the only place that they can receive small group tax credits. And I want just a minute about the tax credit. Starting in 2014, a small employer. There are tax credits available to small employers who have basically low-wage staffs. So employers with fewer than 50 employees and whose average wage, that is the sum of all of the wages paid divided by the number of workers, is $50,000 or less. And then the tax credit is a sliding scale based upon where that average wage is. If it's $25,000 or even lower, it's a 50% tax credit for what the employer pays, and it scales down to 35%. That tax credit is available for 2 years. Again, it's only available in the exchange. I think one of the underlying questions, because I know time is of the essence, is what will happen to the small group market given these reforms, particularly what I call the small groups. Some call it the micro groups under 10. Will they continue to use group purchasing, or will the advantages of the exchange and subsidies change the small group market?
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, we have about 1 minute.
Just on that issue there, because
you've been
with
quiet
that,
today.
That I've tried to do my best for you, Mr. Chair. But this is one that kind of hit a point with me before, because it's kind of a tool to get people into the exchange, and we're going to lose that competition of the private insurance outside, because as a business owner with 5 employees, I'm jumping in for the 50% tax credit. Well, now all of a sudden I lose that tax credit after 2 years, and I have no place to jump back out to. I'm kind of stuck with what's here, and if the rates go up on the exchange, what other options is an individual going to have?
Well, I think that, Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, we've actually tried tax credits in the past in the state, and I'm not convinced they're all that powerful, primarily because the state ones were time limited, and so the issue of an employer of do I want to do it for 2 years, and we don't know whether these would be extended or not. I do think, and I want Laura to correct me if I'm wrong, is that the price of if your group characteristics don't change, your premium is going to go up over time because medical costs go up. But the cost inside or outside the exchange for the same product would be the same, or approximately the same. The exchange does have an administrative load for the exchange. But you know what I'm trying to say is that...
Right, yeah. If the same exact plans are offered in and out, they're priced the same. And I think, you know, it goes back to what Barney's talked about earlier, that there's going to be a lot of variation. But there may be price differences between small group and individuals. And I think that one thing that we've thought a lot about is, will business owners of smaller businesses elect not to offer coverage and send their employees to the individual exchange, for example?
I'm going to call time now. Barney, you did just a fantastic job.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Quite extraordinary.
I hope that if I were in one of your classes, I'd get at least a B.
You would be the teacher.
Thank you, committee.
I want to remind people, if you want to testify on Friday on any of those 4 bills or 3 bills in an LC, please let Tyler know by this afternoon. The governor's folks and the OHA folks will review the 4 bills to start Friday's testimony. That should be about a half an hour, and we'll have the other hour and 15 minutes for testimony. We'll try and divide the time up in a way based on how many people we know are going to be here. So please let Tyler know if you're going to be doing it or not. Again, Mr. Spate, I'm glad you had another opportunity to testify before a committee.
Thank you. I won't make any silly statements.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We are adjourned.